From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Tom Manger, the chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. But joining us now is Luke Torian, a member of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 52nd District in Prince William County. Delegate Torian, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And welcome to your first appearance here on the Politics Hour. Hopefully it will not be your last.
Well, thank you.
Before we get to Virginia, Tom Sherwood, let's take a look at what's been happening in D.C. The 2022 budget was passed by the D.C. Council this past week. There's a lot in there that you would expect from what is generally characterized as a progressive council, including a tax hike on residents who make more than $250,000 a year. Your turn, Tom.
Well, that's one of the aspects of this budget because there was a big gap in the D.C. tax code. If you make $40,000 a year, up to $250,000 a year, you pay the same rate. And so the council adjusted that so people in the higher rates will pay more. But the bottom line on this budget, it's just like the bottom line on every budget in the states, including the district. After a scary pandemic year of 2020, with the infusion of federal funds, billions upon billions of federal funds and more to come, governments are flush with cash, and that's what the district is. So it passed its $17.5 billion budget after some changes that the council made. As you said, a progressive council made some changes with the mayor in terms of what she would spend for converting businesses in downtown to residential housing. There was a concern by Alyssa Silverman, a council member, that not enough of it would be affordable housing. They trimmed back her plans to hire more police in the wake of this violence that's exploded. And they provided more money. That tax increase you mentioned is going to be used for more money for homeless services, housing, and direct payments for the first time to low-income residents. There are lots in there.
Indeed, there is. Now let's go at what the region is experiencing generally, and that is a spike in cases of coronavirus. The D.C. government is requiring COVID-19 vaccine for government workers and for teachers. Vaccine requirements for government workers have also been imposed in Virginia, and I suspect we'll see a lot more from counties in Maryland. Tom Sherwood.
Yes, this is another case where the district is in line with the nation. Excuse me. You know, governments around the country, particularly everywhere but the South, essentially, are getting sick and very frustrated with the people who are just simply refusing to be vaccinated or to wear a mask. And Mayor Bowser joined that this week with declaring that all the government workers, about 35,000, all the city contractors and all the organizations that get grants from the district government must have their employees vaccinated by September 19th or subject those employees to weekly COVID tests. Now, the mayor was going to do this last week, but she had several meetings with the teachers union and other union officials so that when she announced it this week, they were standing by her side. So that was a very big victory for Mayor Bowser.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Luke Torian, a member of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 52nd District in Prince William County. Delegate Torian, vaccine requirements for government workers have also been imposed in Virginia since we're seeing this coronavirus spike. Is that something that you are in favor of?
Yes, I am in favor of it. We really need to get this under control, and I think the actions by the government, by the governor, is warranted. And because one of the things that we do not want to have to experience again is another economic shutdown. And I think the provisions that the governor has put forth, it will be good for the Commonwealth.
Tom Sherwood, it seems to me that with the coming out of the new census, that what we are seeing all around this region is growth. Growth in the District of Columbia, growth in Montgomery and Prince George's County, growth in the surrounding counties, also in Virginia. It says that that growth is really being driven by people of color. Of course, in the District of Columbia, even though it might be driven by people of color in general, the District of Columbia has seen a significant loss of its African-American residents. But I'd just like you to comment on this growth in general.
Well, the region has grown a great deal, the whole metro region, not as fast as the previous decade, but as we'll get into with the delegate, you know, Prince William County is significantly growing, as is Loudoun and other places. In the district, we are now a whiter city. For all those who are worried about gentrification and the displacement of blacks, or even the voluntary nature of blacks leaving the city because they want to or because they can't afford it, we are a whiter city than we have ever been. It's I'm looking for the exact number. It's we are now white people, 38% white. And the black population, which just a couple of decades ago was like 70%, is now down to about 41%. So there's been a significant change, with both an increase also in people who identify as Hispanic and Asians. We are seeing a historic change in the demographics of this District of Columbia.
And I guess that's the same thing you're seeing, Delegate Torian, in Prince William County.
Absolutely. Over the last probably 10 years, we have become a minority-majority county here in Prince William County. So people of color have certainly moved into Prince William County, and there have been dramatic changes in the makeup of our county.
Well, let's get to General Assembly business in general. The General Assembly just approved a spending plan for billions in federal pandemic aid. As chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, you had a hand in how these funds were allocated. Tell us a little bit about what's in the budget.
Well, we did, and we think that we dealing with the American Rescue Plan, we appropriated about $3.2 billion of the $4.3 that was allocated to us by the federal government. And a good portion of that money goes towards accelerating broadband throughout the Commonwealth, providing relief to small businesses, improving school safety and HVAC infrastructure, putting a lot of money towards improving our public health system, our water quality, and helping to extend resources for financial aid to our higher ed institutions.
So we know what this windfall of federal dollars will mean for the states in general. What does it mean in particular for Virginia?
Well, it means that we have to bring back a lot of our small businesses. We run the risk of losing it 30 to 40% of our small business here in the Commonwealth, and small businesses are certainly the engine for us here in Virginia. And also with the pandemic needing and having access to broadband throughout the Commonwealth, areas such as Southwest Virginia in desperate need of broadband access. So we're pleased that the governor has allocated up to $700 million to get broadband over the next 3 to 5 years throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Well, I noticed that this has been your first appearance on the Politics Hour, and usually when we have a guest who has not appeared before, Tom Sherwood does some research into that guest's background. So I'm sure he's chafing at the bit right now to ask you questions about yourself. Tom Sherwood.
Welcome, Delegate Torian. You've been a pastor, is that correct, for 35 years?
I have, two congregations. First, I started out in Charles City County, Guilfield Baptist Church for 4 years, close to 35 years, but 4 years, is right around 30 years, actually, Tom. And I'm in year 26 at First Mount Zion here in Dumfries, Virginia, First Mount Zion Baptist Church in Dumfries.
Well, Tom, he's a graduate of the Howard School of Divinity, among other things, but go ahead.
Yes, he is. Well, you know, there's just been a substantial, we were mentioning the census, I think the Prince William has grown by 20%, according to the numbers that I saw. You're one of the leaders in Northern Virginia and around the state. And it's appearing that the power in Richmond, Virginia, the General Assembly, which is fairly closely divided between House delegates, Republicans and Democrats, and the Senate, that more and more power is about to head towards Northern Virginia. You're a leader of the Democrats in the General Assembly. Do you expect to pick up a lot more seats, not this fall, but in the next 2022 and 23 elections?
Tom, we believe that if we can hold our majority right now, it's a 55-45 Democratic majority in the House, with some retirements and some delegates not returning. Our whole objective is to hold fast our 55 seats, and perhaps there may be two or three seats that we can pick up. So if we can hold our 55 and maybe pick up a couple more seats, get to 57 or 58, we believe that the Democrats will hold the majority for the next 10 years in the House.
And you're running for re-election. You've been there since, I think, 2009. Your Republican opponent is Maria Martin of Triangle. She ran against you, I think, 2 years ago, and you got something like 73% of the vote. But she's running again. She's anti-abortion. And she just tweeted this week that she believes that you cannot, she urges people to wear masks because of COVID. But she says she does not think the state should have the power to require them. What is your thoughts about that, both abortion issues and the mask requirement?
Well, I think that in regards to the abortion issue, I believe that healthcare issues belong to women. They have the right to make their own decisions, and I just believe that women have the right to make their own decisions. So that's a position that I take. And then your other question was?
Anti-abortion and then wearing masks. Both she's more skeptical of masks, as is the Republican Lieutenant Governor candidate, Winsome Sears, who specifically said in the tweet, it wasn't Ms. Mm-hmm. Martin, that the government should not require mandate masks.
I think that the governor of the Commonwealth has a responsibility to the citizens of the Commonwealth, and given all of the CDC and science and the data that is provided to the governor, then the governor has a responsibility for the health and care of his citizens. And if the administration believes that mask wearing will help keep us safe, keep our businesses open, keep our schools open, I'm in support of that decision.
And let me ask one more political thing before Kojo cuts me off here. You represent, all of your 80,000 constituents are in Prince William County. It's down 95. It's Woodbridge, Dell City. It's where Potomac Mills is. It's also where Peter Newsom, the former police chief of the District of Columbia, moved in February to be the chief of Prince William County. How's he doing so far?
I've had an opportunity to meet with the chief, and so far right now, he's doing well. He has made it a priority to meet with all the stakeholders here in Prince William, and things are going well.
Okay, here now, let's go to the phones. Here now is Jackie in Alexandria, Virginia. Jackie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for your time. Question, in Alexandria, they're beginning a pilot program that will assist approximately 150 residents and provide them with $500 a month for, I think, about 2 years to help, help them in with the economy and the situation that have occurred. Alexandria's median income is $127,000. I am one of these people who, I just moved here 5 years ago. It is very hard to afford. I am one of the working people here. However, these type of programs never help my situation. They're helping people, I think that for two people in a household, it has to be an income of $54,000, which is so far below the median income. And I'm a little bit higher than that, but I'm still struggling. Rent in Alexandria is ridiculous. We're paying $2,500, $2,600 a month, and we get no help. So what is out there for people like me?
I think you're probably speaking about a federal assistance program that's from the federal government. And I agree with you that you are in a high rent district. And I'm not I'm not sure. Well, they have a cutoff, obviously, for medium income, and the situation that you're in is one that that is regrettable, because you're just above that line of cutoff, and the program that you're probably speaking about is a federal program, and I'm not sure what else is out there for folks who are in your position.
Jackie, thank you very much for your call, and good luck to you. Delegatorian Prince William County just reached high levels of transmission of COVID in the community, and vaccination rates have slowed dramatically. You mentioned earlier that it has now become a majority-minority county, and we have had the experience in the District of Columbia of having lower vaccination rates in our predominantly low-income African-American communities. What are you seeing and hearing in Prince William County, and what will it take to get more people vaccinated?
I think what is, Kojo, what is required is that those of us who have been vaccinated continue to do our public service announcements, continue to work with our health department here in Prince William County, continue to get the message out through our churches and our civic organizations, allow individuals to know that if you want to move freely within this county, getting vaccinated should become a priority. If we want to keep our schools open for our sons and daughters so that they can go back to in-person learning, we need for all of our educators and administrators and support system folks to be vaccinated, because it is our responsibility to share the benefits of folks being vaccinated, and that's what we're seeking to do.
What are you seeing among your parishioners at First Mount Airy Baptist?
Well, at First Mount Zion,
That's
all right. At First Mount Zion, we are seeing members being vaccinated. We're seeing members who are encouraging members, their fellow members, to be vaccinated as well. And we're practicing all of the CDC guidelines as far as wearing masks when folks are coming into our facility, having their temperature checked. We're still practicing social distancing, and we're monitoring how much of our facility we're giving members access to as things improve.
Tom Sherwood.
Delegatorian, I mentioned that you're from the Prince William County, the 95 corridor. That's where Potomac Mills is. Last time I checked, it was the largest outlet mall in Virginia. Now, the others have opened in Maryland and other places. But what has been the COVID impact in in Prince William County, specifically on business losses and specifically Potomac Mills, where I bought a few things in my past?
Actually, Potomac Mills is doing fairly well. Probably 90% of our stores at Potomac Mills are open and operational. And I'm not a big shopper, but when I do drive by, I go to Costco's for my gas, and it stays pretty busy. And I think people are out spending money and glad that Potomac Mills is open, and they're out shopping and spending money.
Okay, and I know you're a Democrat, but I want you to put on your analyst hat and your minister hat and tell me what you think about the lieutenant candidate for governor for the Democrats, Hala Ayala, who's a delegate from Prince William County. Were you surprised that she won, and how do you see her in her run against Winsome Sears, the Republican candidate?
I have worked with Delegate Hala Ayala in the General Assembly probably for the last 4 to 6 years, and she is extremely hard worker. She campaigned very hard to win the primary. She was outspent by one of her primary candidates, and she just went door to door, did a lot of door knocking and meeting the voters, and because of that hard work, she was able to win the primary and become a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. I think she's going to continue the hard work. She recognizes that this is going to be a very tough race, and I believe she's fit for the job, and she would be a great lieutenant governor for the Commonwealth.
And what about the race for governor? Glenn Youngkin, the Republican nominee, who has a great deal of money, has run a more conservative, swung more conservative than many people had thought he would do, thinking he might try to move towards the middle and suburban women voters. But he seems to be tacking to the right against Terry McAuliffe. How do you see that?
I believe very strongly in Governor McAuliffe because of his experience. He has won before. He has been the chief executive officer for the Commonwealth as governor for four years. He has the experience. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he understands what Virginia needs to continue to move forward during these very trying times. And the voters recognize when people began to shift in their politics as well. So that is not a surprise to those of us in Virginia when we see someone shifting in their positions.
Well, speaking of elections, Virginia is setting aside $1.5 million to fight voter misinformation about state elections, of course, plus $3 million to expand early voting. But what kinds of misinformation are you anticipating? What have you seen?
Well, I am not anticipating. We're just preparing in the event that when you have an election like we're having, Kojo, in Virginia for the House of Delegates, which we're going to have several close races, it's not uncommon for misinformation about how people vote, where they vote, and who's casting votes here, people voting more than once. Those kinds of things occur all the time in elections.
Well, here now is Greg in Frederick, Maryland. Greg, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I just had a question. I'm a federal employee, and I'm not looking at the vaccine mandates and trying to understand. recently, both the CDC director and Fauci came on and said that, you know, this Delta variant, the vaccine's neither stop infection nor stop transmission of the virus. And so I'm just trying to understand what a mass vaccination mandate is going to do to stop the spread, because the logic doesn't really make sense to me anymore. And I think things have changed a little bit. So
when you
I
say
seem to be hearing,
when you say the logic doesn't make sense to you anymore, the logic of wearing masks to prevent the spread of COVID-19?
No, I was talking about the vaccine mandate. Yeah, I wasn't talking about the mask, right?
Okay.
The mask makes sense.
Well, we only have about a minute or so left, so allow me to have Delegate Torian respond.
Fauci didn't say what he said he said.
In short, I believe very strongly that folks should be vaccinated. I believe that Dr. Fauci and the CDC says that we should be wearing masks to prevent the spreading of certainly the Delta variant, and I'm in support of that. I think any preventive measures that we can take to keep each other safe, we should practice those measures.
Well, the legislature made the choice to set aside about $1.1 billion in case the pandemic worsens. Why wouldn't you spend it right now?
Precisely to your point, Kojo. We set that money aside because we're not exactly sure what this Delta variant is going to, how it's going to impact the Commonwealth of Virginia over the next several months. And we believe that it's prudent for us to have resources available for the next administration coming in January to have access to resources to continue to ensure the safety and well-being of the citizens of the Commonwealth. And that's why we did not spend all $4.3 billion. The intent was to hold some of those resources back, but yet we were able to address the immediate needs that we have here in Virginia relative to responding to the COVID-19 and the Delta variant that we're experiencing now.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for now. Luke Torian is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates representing the 52nd District in Prince William County. This has been his first appearance on this broadcast. We hope you'll join us again, Delegate Torian.
I look forward to the invite, sir.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, Tom Manger joins us, Chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Tom Manger, the Chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. Chief Manger, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to do it, Kojo.
Before we get specifically to Chief Major Tom Sherwood, let's talk a little bit about something that I know he's interested in because he has served as police chief in both Fairfax and Montgomery counties. The census that we talked about earlier, data is released to showing that the growth is also taking place in Maryland and, of course, in Montgomery County, where the chief last served as police chief, Tom Sherwood.
Yes, Montgomery County is undergoing a significant change. I'm looking forward to hearing what Chief Manger says about it because he's so familiar with Montgomery County. And I was in Bethesda this week, standing next to the Tasty Diner, looking up at the Marriott headquarters building and just marveling at the changes of Bethesda itself and the people who are moving to downtown Bethesda. So, Chief Manger,
your view of these developments?
Yes.
You know, look, Montgomery County is a great place to live and work. I've been a resident there now for, 17, 18 years now, and was a resident there prior to my move over to Northern Virginia when I was chief over in Fairfax. But it's a great county. But I will tell you that since I was a kid, you know, living there as a teenager and coming back in the early 2000s when I became chief, it just the change was amazing. I mean, it was just unrecognizable from what it was when I was a young man. And even now, as I drive through different places, and of course, I was all over the county when I was chief there, you would see things that it's like, well, when did this happen? When did this building go up? When did this neighborhood, get built? And it was just, I will say that most of the growth was, I think, smartly planned and really kept the integrity of what Montgomery County prides itself on being. But Tom, I've had many of those moments where, you know, you go someplace that you've been many times before and then you notice something new and it's an amazing place, that's for certain.
Well, Tom Sherwood, Chief. Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say before we move on to something, I have a very important question. It's the number one question for the new chief of the Capitol Police. And we got lots of issues to discover, but I just want to ask a very quick question. Everyone wants to know, do you or do you not support sledding on the Capitol Hill grounds?
I am 100% in support of sledding on the Capitol grounds. And if it wasn't for the fact that I'd worry about, breaking a hip or something, I'd be down there doing it myself.
Okay, no fence to block it.
certainly no permanent fence to block it.
Again, our guest is Tom Manger, Chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. Chief Manger, you have been on WMU Airwaves several times before, especially on the Kojo Namdi show. But you were retired before you took this role as U.S. Capitol Police. So I'm wondering, are congratulations in order at this point?
I would say, look, I'm very pleased to be in this position, but in all candor, I was very happily retired. I was doing consulting work and was being very selective about the work that I was doing. Still felt a great passion for improving the police profession and was doing work that I thought would help that cause. But it was January 6th that changed that for me, and I remember being riveted watching what was going on here at the Capitol and thinking I wished I wasn't retired. And it was the first and only time that I had that feeling since I retired from Montgomery County. But I as time went on and the folks that were recruiting for folks to throw their hat in the ring for the job, when they contacted me, I thought, I'm really wasn't interested in, getting back into the profession, but with the experience that I've had, with the relationships that I have developed, I really thought that I had something to offer the U.S. Capitol Police and wanted to bring that experience in an effort to help this department, a great department, but, all departments can benefit from, fresh eyes and certainly efforts to improve, and I wanted to be a part of that.
Okay, so congratulations. So tell us a little bit about what that process was like. You said you were recruited for this position?
I think there were a number of people that got a call saying, "Hey, would you be interested?" And I thought a lot about it, talked to my wife about it, and I came to the conclusion that I did want to throw my hat in the ring, and I must tell you again, in all candor, once I started, I was afraid that perhaps I would immediately think, "Oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into?" But none of that. I mean, I'm so pleased to be here. Great working with great men and women, and I think we've got a great plan to move forward. And so I'm happy I'm here. So, the process took really a couple of months or several months from the time that I expressed interest to the time that a selection was made. A lot of interviews. But I was, during the interviews, I was doing as much interviewing as they were doing of me. I was doing of them just to make sure that this would be a good fit. And I believed it was. And so far, it's turned out to be a great fit.
Sure. Chief, two questions about this. One, you were hired by the Capitol Police Board, which runs the security issues on the Hill. One, did you sign a contract for a specific time? Is it open-ended? What is your commitment to the job legally?
So it's open-ended, and I serve at the pleasure of the Capitol Police Board, and this is the same level of job security I've had since the day I was appointed police chief by Catherine Hanley back in 1998. You serve at the pleasure of your boss, and I used to talk to my friends who were elected sheriffs, and they would lament about having to be elected every 4 years, and I looked at them and I said, "Look, I got to get elected every day." So right. So it's open-ended, and I serve at the pleasure of the board.
It's important. The Capitol Police Board is made up of the architect of the Capitol and the sergeant at arms of the House and the Senate. It's a 3-person board, and you're an ex officio member of the board as being the chief. One of the concerns that was raised by the mayor and Police Chief Conte here in the District of Columbia is that after the confusion around January the 6th, is that the District Metropolitan Police Department, as important as it is around the Capitol, has no representation on the Capitol Police Board. I know you can't make this change, but do you think, given the importance of the Metropolitan Police, that there ought to be some representative from the city police department that sits in on that board so it knows what the board is doing in terms of the security that you're doing now, and more importantly, the security you'll be doing in the future?
I think the way to accomplish that, the simplest way to accomplish that, and what I have done since my first day here, was to have close communication with Chief Conte, and he and I have been friends for a few years, and there's really going to be no issues in terms of us keeping them informed. On National Night Out, I was over at the 1D celebration that was going on in the First District, which covers Capitol Hill. So I've gotten to know the commander of the First District. I've put strategies in place to make sure that information that we put out gets out to the residents that live around this complex, so that they're aware of what's going on. But to your question specifically, I don't know that there has to be a representative. This board is it's only 3 people. I'm the 4th as the ex officio. I'm not a voting member per se. But so the way to make sure that this is not an issue going forward is to have very clear and frequent communications between the Capitol Police Department and MPD, and that'll start right at the top, because Robert and I speak often, and hopefully that communication will result in all coordinated efforts, whether it's just everyday things or whether it's a special event.
Maybe a memorandum of understanding, but I'll let you work that out. Thank you for that answer. A lot of people who live up there and those of us who live around the city are concerned that the D.C. police are so important, but they are not in the decision-making. Thank you.
Chief Manger, I know you have ties to local police departments in the region, but there are many federal law enforcement agencies in Washington as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how you collaborate with those agencies and which of those you probably be working most closely with?
Well, probably most closely with MPD, but there's other federal agencies that we work hand in hand with. The U.S. Secret Service is probably number one on that list because of the fact that folks on the executive branch are very often find themselves over here at the Capitol, and our folks find themselves over at the White House. So there's everyday communication and coordination with the Secret Service. But even the FBI, ATF, all the federal law enforcement agencies, we have a good, close relationship with. And one of the reasons for that is just that we share intelligence and share information. We all have some aspect of having protection responsibilities with our agencies. And the fact that we are working side by side in different fusion centers and that we're sharing intelligence just makes the entire region safer.
Our guest is Tom Manger, Chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. Tom Sherwood, we've gotten several emails asking us to address the incorrect statement from the caller who said vaccines are ineffective, when in fact the vaccines have been effective to the point where I think the number of people who have been fully vaccinated who have died of COVID-19 stands at less than 1%. Am I correct?
Yes, the caller said flatly that the Dr. Fauci and the CDC have said that vaccines are not won't quote stop the vaccine. No one has said that.
Stop the virus.
Stop the virus. They have said over and over and over again to their blue in the face, the vaccine significantly curbs the virus. In fact, all the people who now are getting infected, something like 96-97%, the people who are getting infected now are people who have not taken the vaccine. I'm glad you cleared that up because I was irritated when the guy said it.
Chief Manger, are Capitol Police now expected to be vaccinated? What's the protocol there?
There's no mandate that they be vaccinated, but we have a fairly significant percentage of our officers that in fact have been vaccinated. Still, I was talking to the attending physician of the Capitol just a couple of days ago, and he said that if there are any officers that have not yet been vaccinated, that they can still just walk in and get vaccinated. I think the point that you just made is so important. We've had a number. We get notified every time a member of our organization tests positive for COVID. But to a person, those that have been vaccinated are just experiencing mild symptoms, and there's not been any serious implications from getting the virus with the folks that have been vaccinated. And so I think it's tremendously important that, you know, if you can get vaccinated, we've been pushing that throughout our organization.
Here's Susan in Alexandria, Virginia. Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm hearing all this talk lately about how we've got to hire a whole lot more police, both MPD and Capitol Police. And it brings to my mind the situation a number of years ago when there was a similar push to hire a whole lot more police. And it turned out that some of them were bad apples. We had police who were notifying the drug dealers of when they were going to be raided, and it was a big problem. And that concerns me, and I want to make sure that you are cognizant of that and what steps are being taken to be sure that the police who are hired are the right guys.
Well, I know over the years, Tom Sherwood and others have reported about the 1989 hiring in the District of Columbia that was apparently a bit too hasty. But your turn, Chief Manger.
So, Susan, I share the same concern and have for many years. Hiring the right people for this job is a huge responsibility for any police chief. And as what we all have learned is that not everyone is suited for this job. It takes folks with a particular personality. You look for traits. Obviously, you look for folks that have integrity, but you look for folks that have empathy, that have a spirit for public service. Those are the kinds of traits and qualities that you want, when you're looking for the right folks to hire. you know, we can train them. I can train anybody to how to be a police officer, but if they don't have that those right character traits to begin with, you may run into problems. I am fully aware of some of the hiring pushes that have not turned out well. Read about them, heard about them, seen it, you know, in other departments. So as we continue our push, and you know, we may end up getting more positions, but just filling the positions that we have now that are vacant with all the retirements and folks that left the department, even, you know, especially after January 6th, we have to make sure that we are hiring folks that have those qualities, that we're hiring folks that that represent the diversity of the community that we're serving, and just folks that have the right heart for this job. And I look and speak with the new recruits, it looks like we're doing that job, but the only way we're going to know is to hold folks accountable and, you know, keep track of what they do and how they do it, to ensure that they are, in fact, the right folks for this job, and holding them accountable if they're not.
Susan, thank you very much for your call. Tom Sherwood?
Chief, thank you.
Yes, sir.
This is a good segue for this. Chief, you've been part of the national debate about overly aggressive policing since George Floyd. You've witnessed the eruptions across this country and around the world about police overreacting. Police have a dangerous job. Let's give that as a given. Most officers try to do good jobs. There are strong views, though, that too many police departments train officers by default to use overwhelming force to lock down situations rather than training them to do the more difficult de-escalation. The police problem can't be just a few bad apples. What's your personal view of the training to get somebody, even if they mean well, to know what to do in these crisis situations?
So, Tom, I agree with everything you said in the premise, with one exception. De-escalation is not the more difficult thing to do. In fact, once you learn how to do it, once you're good at it, that is actually an easier way to gain compliance with folks that you're dealing with. And this goes back to hiring the right people in the first place that, you know, that have that, you know, patience as one of their qualities. It's making sure that you do give them the skills. You know, de-escalation, a lot of it, some people have that knack to be able to calm things down naturally, but it's a teachable skill. It's a learnable skill.
Okay.
Where the way you talk to people, things you say, and as important, things you don't say, you know, that will escalate a situation. So I think the de-escalation training is tremendously important. What I'm happy to see is that it is now becoming more incorporated in every police department. And because back when I first did it in Montgomery County, there weren't a lot of police departments that were doing it. Now it's becoming more the norm.
And if I could follow up, this is an important part. If you know, a lot of police departments have routinely bought surplus war weapons and machinery from the Defense Department, taking almost a warlike footing in urban areas. Will we see more warlike equipment on the Capitol grounds? We already have those gate barriers that give the Hill a bunker mentality. Will we see war equipment on the police force?
Well, the short answer to that question is no. You won't see more of it. But here's the key. You know, and here the example that everybody wants to point to is the fact that there were one or two police departments in this country that actually got bayonets from the military, you know, in the military surplus program, and which sounds just awful. And in fact, but if you dig a little deeper and you ask them, well, why in the world would you want bayonets? I mean, police don't need those kinds of things. They said, oh, well, we wanted them to be able to give officers to cut people out of their seatbelts if they were involved in a crash and were unable to get out of their seatbelts. Okay, well, there's plenty of other things that are probably better for that than a bayonet. But it wasn't like, you know, cops were going to use those things, you know, as the military would use them. But then you get the things like, you know, people, these, you know, 12-man departments who, you know, get tanks, you know, get armored vehicles. And you think, oh, my God, what do they need those for? And it looks awful, that sort of thing. But having used armored vehicles to rescue hostages, to get the SWAT team to be able to throw a phone into a building so that we could negotiate with someone who was engaged in a barricade situation. There are uses that do make sense. The problem is it's the misuse. What I don't like is when, and I told my folks, a lot of folks were surprised when they found out that Montgomery County had a couple of armored vehicles. And I said, well, the reason you're surprised is because we don't send them down the street in parades and all that sort of thing. We use them when we need them. And I could justify every time we need them. And most of the time when I explained the scenario about what we, what we use them for, people understood why that we needed, to be able to get from point A to point B in an area that it was not safe to be in. And
you got it.
Thank you, Chief. That's good.
We got an email from Greg who said there's a rumor of an upcoming rally supporting those who protested on January 6th. How do you feel about that? Well, more importantly, what do you know about that, and how are you preparing?
Well, what I know about it is more important than what I feel about it. Because I got a job to do here. First of all, there is a permit for a demonstration at the Capitol I don't remember what the name of the group was. It's something like Forward America or so, and don't quote me on that because I don't remember the name, but it is in fact in support of the folks that were arrested as of as a result of what they did at the Capitol on January 6th. There may be some members of Congress who actually attend the rally, the folks that are coordinating it have said, I've read in the paper that they've said to the media that they don't expect any problems, but our job is to make sure that they can exercise their First Amendment rights, that they can that they can conduct this rally
even as you have to do your job to protect the citizens and the people who happen to be in the Capitol. I say that because we're almost out of time. I mentioned earlier that you've been on the Kojo Namdi show quite a few times, but more importantly, you know someone who is an integral part of WMU, and I know he happens to be listening right now because, well, he's our call screener. Bruce Romer. Tell us how you know Bruce Romer.
So Bruce Romer was the chief administrative officer in Montgomery County, working for County Executive Doug Duncan in 2004, and hired a very young and handsome Tom Manger to be his police chief. Now, I've since aged not very gracefully, but Bruce is one of the folks that's responsible for a lot of my success.
Well, unlike you, Bruce is still handsome, so we're happy to have him here. Chief Tom Manger is the chief of the U.S. Capitol Police. Chief Manger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And good luck to you. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Alexia Brown, and our managing producer, of course, is Inga-Lisa Schorpsdorf. Our first phone screener I mentioned earlier, the one and only Bruce Romer. And our engineer today, Natalie Yu of Lifker. Tom Sherwood, any big plans this weekend?
I'm going to continue to wear my mask and avoid COVID-19 Delta variants of any kind.
Sounds like a plan to me. I plan on doing the same thing this weekend. I hope you all out there are also doing the same thing. Stay safe, have a pleasant weekend, and thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Natalie Yur of Livker. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.